Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, this is Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Erica Council grew up among food royalty. One of her grandmothers owned the classic soul food restaurant Mama Dips in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And now Erica has found her own prominent place in Southern food, especially through her biscuits, the centerpiece of her Bomb Biscuits pop-up meals in Atlanta. But it wasn't a smooth path from there to here. Council intended to stay out of the food business, but it drew her back in. And that story is what we explore in today's episode. Here's our conversation. I want to ask about your grandmothers, plural, because I know from what I've read and heard about you, they sort of played a large part in shaping who you've become. And I know one of them was pretty well known in the, at least in the food world, so maybe we can start with her. Can you tell me about Mildred Council a little bit?
Sure. So Mildred Council is my paternal grandmother. And she passed away, a restaurant in Chapel Hill, North Carolina called Mama Dips. It's kind of a Southern institution.
It very much is.
Yeah. Not just her. I mean, my aunts and my uncle, but mainly my aunts sort of followed in her footsteps. So any time spent with that side of my family, you know, I was surrounded by people who... you know, in my opinion, very much shaped sort of the food ways of North Carolina, that triangle area, whether it was my grandma Dip, who began that sort of, I guess you could say, dynasty with her her cooking, a restaurant, and cookbooks, and, you know, branching off into packaging products, which... when you think about African Americans and in enterprise and building a business, you know, sometimes we aren't afforded the same opportunities as our as our white counterparts. But she very much sort of paved that way with, you know, she had barbecue sauce and cornbread mix. And you know, my aunt Niecy, she also has her own cake mix. It's sold in all the Whole Foods. And my cousin Tanya, who is, we share her as a grandmother, she has her own storefront with products that she makes as well. So,
yeah, and did you work at Mama Dips when you were growing up?
I did not work there. I mean, only when I visited my dad, I would go and hang out. And, you know, you hanging out meant you work, but not like,
you know. So you would stop by and they'd make you work for a while.
Yeah, yeah, but not like, you know, a paying job.
So what did you learn from her as far as cooking or anything else?
Yeah, so I learned sort of, I guess, the business of, I think the key thing I learned from her is how hard the restaurant industry is. And I think that has kept me, I don't know, I think that sort of shaped the journey for me. I'll say that would be in the most profound lesson, which is why I sort of went to college and pursued a completely different route. I probably, if I had not seen how difficult it is, especially for African Americans, and sort of learned from what I saw, I probably would have just sort of said, oh, I'm going to be a chef and just be famous because my grandmother is famous and, you know, she makes it so easy. But she always did a great job of showing you it's not. The processes of seeing her make biscuits and cornbread and pies and everyone that worked there, frying chicken, you know, also seeing, you know, it could be a 15-hour day, you know, and there could be no people coming in that day, you know, and that kind of shaped sort of, even though I eventually came back around to it, that really shaped sort of my view into this, you know, into the culinary world. It made it very realistic for me, whereas some of my friends, you know, they'll watch these cooking, they were watching, you know, these top chefs on TV, and they're like, oh, this is exactly what I'm going to do, without realizing that's not at all what restaurant life is like.
Yeah, you don't see what's behind the scenes there, right?
Right.
And
right.
So you also have talked about your other grandmother.
Yeah.
And how she influenced you. Oh, tell us a little bit about her.
So I guess, you know, for her, I spent a lot of time with her. So I always try to, I'm hesitant when, you know, people are interviewing me, they'll ask me about my grandma Dip, but I always want to make sure that I mention my granny, Geraldine, so they kind of know, like, a lot of things that I learned from her as far as the stories about the civil rights movement. So she was very active during the civil rights movement, and she was one of those people that you read about, the black women who made dinners, the plate sale, so you can say it, and sort of organized to raise funds, to whether it was to raise funds to get to see MLK speak in Washington, or to fund, you know, a bus to get down to the Montgomery boycotts. It was, you know, a lot of the stories that she told me sort of revolved around, you know, oh, I made this recipe, but let me tell you one time I made it. And I don't know if it was intentional or what, but it was kind of this, you know, I'm standing at the table and she's telling me these stories, you know, a lot of them, you know, at a young age, I didn't even believe. You know, there was this, you know, I was started doing research. She got Alzheimer's right before she passed away. And I started doing research and was writing down stories, which is why I started blogging, of things that she told me. And there was this one particular story about this doctor, Dr. Sharp, out of North Carolina. And, you know, she told me this thing because she made this sort of fish, almost a fish pate dish. We would eat it with crackers and things. And it just seemed so fancy, you know what I mean? Like, in comparison to, and I remember asking, like, where did you, because it was kind of like a smoky fish. And she said, oh, Dr. Sharp showed us this. And, you know, she starts talking about this fancy white guy from New York who bought this property off the Hammocks, which is going past Wilmington.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he had this property out there. And a gentleman that worked, a black gentleman that worked that land, he befriended. And, you know, he asked him, like, how can I make this place a haven for some other people, you know, to enjoy? And the gentleman told him about the Negro Teachers League of North Carolina, and the fact that, you know, you couldn't patron except, I think, one or two beaches in North Carolina at that time. All the rest were segregated. So my grandmother was one of the people who got an opportunity to get on a bus and spend time, you know, at this sort of almost a mansion on an island. And when she talked about it, she just talked about it like, you know, like it was such this fantasy, right? And, you know, I would always remember that story because it stuck out to me, you know, as something so crazy. Like, first, you couldn't go to the beach. And then, you know, wow, you guys, he just invited all you strangers to his house. So when she passed away and I started putting sort of the stories together, I looked him up. And it was true. I mean, not that I did not, you know, doubted her, but you never know. You know, grandmas will tell you stuff to make themselves seem interesting. And it just was so fascinating. But just remembering that story, and it took me to reading about this guy. Like, she just had so many things like that. And, you know, for me, her particular part of my journey was, you know, creating food, but also kind of keeping it in the community and sort of taking this and how can I uplift my community in particular with the food that I'm serving, whether it be, you know, having kids come in and showing them how to cook and just providing some type of safe haven, or, you know, having pop-ups and cooking for everyone, and the money that I raise, I would take and it goes to a program that I was doing on the side to teach STEM to kids, basically inner city kids in schools. So yeah.
And so I know you said you didn't, you know, once you saw how hard your grandmother, Mama Deb, worked, you know, that was not your goal to be doing that for a living. But I read that you, when you were in college, you sold plates out of your dorm room.
Exactly.
Is that right?
I did.
And where did you go to school?
North Carolina A&T.
And so how did, Like, were you just, was it like a hot plate or something?
Yeah, I got in trouble for that, though. I don't know if you should put that in a podcast. Then they'll remember me. But yeah, I got in trouble. And it's funny because that's kind of where I got the nickname Southern Soufflé. It was kind of somebody being a hater. And, oh, she thinks she's Southern Soufflé. But yeah, I was like I could make anything on that hot plate. Like mac and cheese was kind of my specialty. I would just sort of boil the noodles and then do like a bechamel sauce. And it was really simple and sort of sit it on the stove and then let it kind of get crispy around the edge on the like hot plate, let it get crispy around the edges and put it in these little like aluminum, you know, you can buy the little like loaf to go aluminum things and get them right. And so I would just be selling them like that with a little aluminum foil on the top and good to go. Even though I was very cynical about anything that had to do with hard labor in general. I was like, no, I'm not, definitely not going to be cleaning up behind people in a restaurant and cooking food all day. And then here I come and here I'm doing it again, you know.
So what led you, did you just need money or did you feel some need to cook or what was that?
I think it was a combination of both. You know, I felt a need to cook. I think it still connected me. It still grounded me because here I was at school and nobody was cooking, you know, and I had pretty much grown up, you know, separate from my mother who never cooked and was very, oh, let's go to the restaurant. Everyone else in my life cooked and, you know, to the point of the fresh vegetables, you know, only thing that should come out of a can is paint is one of my favorite sayings.
That's a great one.
Yeah. It kind of came to a point. I was like, okay, you know, I think it helped calm my nerves from being homesick and, you know, also I made really good mac and cheese, so it earned me some money until, you know, we got in trouble for having a hot plate in the corner.
So what did you end up, like, majoring in? What was your career in before all this other stuff started?
Computer science. Uh-huh. And I went on to try to just be something. It's completely opposite of, you know, food.
Right.
But it never left me because I'd still, you know, one thing about corporate America is it's a bitch. And if you're a Black woman trying to pursue a career in technology, I mean, it would have, it's almost kind of like, you know, when I sit back and I think about this journey, because I've been doing that for 15, 16, 17 years. And think about how difficult it was, you know, how I watched my family with the restaurant and, you know, some other people. Because on my mom's side, we had a family, it was a distant cousin, but Scott's Barbecue of Goldsboro, North Carolina.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's where my grandmother lived. And I spent a majority of my life in Goldsboro, North Carolina. So I saw that aspect from the barbecue standpoint and then Mama Dips. And it was just kind of like, gosh, this is hard. But I kind of would find solace in coming home and making food. And then on Sunday, people would come to my house. It's just open. Anyone who wants to come and eat, you know, that's kind of what I was doing. I was still, like, making pies and stuff on the side and selling them. And it kind of helped remove me sort of from the stress and things that I was facing. I'm trying to make it in corporate America. Going the software engineer route definitely has afforded me a life that has given me the ability to be in a better position to say, financially, let's look at opening a restaurant versus trying to just kickstart that shit from nothing, you know? So I won't take that away, but the complications and I guess the obstacles are, you know, one, you could say one was difficult than the other. The one I pursued probably was more difficult than the one I denied myself.
That's an interesting lesson to learn.
Yeah.
When you get down the road a while. Huh?
Yeah, a while, almost 20 years.
Yeah.
A while.
And are you still doing the software engineering?
I do. I mean, I consult, so I work from home.
Have a lot of jobs.
I have a lot of jobs.
So I know you're doing that. You're doing this website. You're doing these pop-up meals in Atlanta.
Yeah.
You know, you're writing recipes. I know you work with corporations, food companies to develop recipes for them. How do you, like, dole out your time?
I don't know. I'm absolutely terrible at that. I honestly don't write on the website as much anymore. And I say that because, you'll understand, by giving away free content.
Sure.
And it got to a point to where, like, I had a very specific voice, I would say. And, you know, I would go to some of these food blogger conferences, and they just really just turned me completely off.
How so?
It's like a cross between the Harper Valley PTA and Stepford Wives. And it's just like, it just wasn't my reality. It didn't, you know, don't get me wrong, not all of them that way, but just too many. And then, you know, people would sort of steal the content. Those who had a bigger following would steal it. I remember reading this one particular person's post, and she wrote about tamales in Mississippi. And it was kind of after I had made a reference about the tamales in Mississippi and sort of the history around that. And, you know, it was a white woman. And she wrote about, you know, meeting this black man, his weathered old face. It was just completely out of the realm of anything that she had ever written before. So much to the fact that people were sending it to me because some of the references in it were references to things that I had written in a roundabout way. And it was picked up by all kinds of, like, Bon Appetit, Food 52, you know, as this, you know, fantabulous story, which is bullshit, you know. And it kind of got to a point to where, you know, I was tired of giving away free content. I wanted to pursue a sort of a different avenue. While I like to write about food, I think my strongest point is actually feeding people. Yeah.
So I know as you mentioned, you've kind of become known for your biscuits, which I can personally vouch for. They're awesome.
Thank you so much.
You know, I read that you mentioned somewhere that your two grandmothers, again, mm-hmm. made very different types of biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering sort of where yours landed in relation to the ones that you had at those houses.
I think I'm an in between.
What was the difference?
So my grandma Dip seems to, her biscuits are more like beaten biscuits, and you know, her biscuits are quick biscuits, light and fluffy.
And is that because she had to make them quick for the restaurant business?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, mainly. I mean, they're amazing. Whereas my other grandmother, she just sort of, I mean, her biscuits stood really tall. And she also made the angel biscuits where you add the yeast to them. So some of the more, I guess, complex processes I saw from that side. You know, even taking it a step further from biscuits, my great aunt Fanny, she lived to be 103. She used to keep, like, multiple jars in her kitchen. They would be sitting in different places. One would be in the shade, one would be in the sunlight. And so she would just sort of peek in each one to determine, oh, like, that one's not ready yet. Doesn't smell right. Let me check this one. And so from those little jars, she would take, you know, at the time, which what I thought smelled like rotten eggs, and not rotten eggs, it just smelled sour, and add it to this, you know, this sort of grainy, like, dough. And she would make the best sort of this brownish, sort of sour-tasting bread I've ever had in my life.
And so were those jars like starters of some kind?
Yep, that's exactly what it was. And, you know, I kind of learned these techniques from, you know, all three of these women and, you know, some other women too, because, you know, Aunt Mabel made these butter rolls that you could only cook in aluminum foil, which is crazy. But it's kind of these, the more sort of, I guess, techniques or more complex techniques I saw from different people, but I think that was more because they had more time and I spent more time with them. You know what I mean?
When we come back, Erica Council gets into the nitty gritty of making biscuits, including the buttermilk she'll drive across state lines to buy. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey y'all, this is Tommy. This episode of Southbound, as well as everything else we do here at WFAE, depends on support from our listeners. So we're making the humble request for you to donate to WFAE during our fundraising campaign. We'd love for you to become a sustaining member by sending us a regular amount of money every month. And we're offering lots of rewards for sustaining members, including signed copies of my book, The Elephant in the Room. But even if you have just a small one-time gift to give, we'll be grateful. It all adds up. So if you'd like to be part of our community, go to WFAE.org right now and click the donate button. I'll be here when you get back with the rest of our conversation with Erica Council. Are there any, I'm not as worried about your particular recipe or anything, but are there any, like, things that you do when you make biscuits that maybe the average cook wouldn't think about?
Let's see. Well, for starters, I want to say I see a lot of biscuit recipes online, and, you know, it's the ones that are, you have to use a combination of this highly, it's just bullshit. I learned how to make biscuits using Piggly Wiggly all-purpose flour.
Right.
They were baking powder biscuits. And I think really the key is keeping that butter as cold as you can, even if it means, you know, making those biscuits, cutting them out, putting them on a sheet pan, and sticking them in the freezer for 30 minutes. You know, I mean, if that butter starts to melt, if your hands are too hot, use a fork to break the butter in there, and the pastry, pastry cutter, I mean, to break it in, and the buttermilk.
Now, let me stop you just a second. You're talking to somebody who doesn't know any of these techniques. So why does it matter that the butter is cold?
So when it's like, it's the fat. And so the, okay, I'm not a scientist, but once you kind of put the butter, once it starts to melt, if it's cold, that means it takes longer for that butter to melt, and it makes them rise, and it's the sort of the gluten spreading away from that fat. You know, if it's melt, it's kind of like ingrained into the dough, so it doesn't rise as it should. And that's sort of a ghetto explanation.
No, that's I believe that's called layman's terms.
No.
And you were about to say something about buttermilk.
Yeah, and the buttermilk, it's just sort of getting the best sort of creamiest buttermilk. Some of that buttermilk is just too watery. That just doesn't work for me.
I read that there's some particular kind that you like will travel to get if you can get it.
Yes. So Cruise Dairy Farm, I think I call them the Beyonce of buttermilk because they are. I mean, it's literally the best buttermilk I've ever had. It reminds me of my granddaddy's buttermilk where he would drink it cold, right from a glass. It's just creamy, and it's not, you know, some buttermilk is just too watery and sour to drink, and it's just, I don't know what's in it. I think they make it from a magical place that they, you know, probably from some far off alien planet. But no, it's right there in Tennessee. So yeah, I'll drive to Chattanooga and just go to that first. There's a Whole Foods right off the exit, and that's what I'll just buy out the entire stock they have.
So I know there's been, you know, I've seen stories and I'm sure you have too about sort of the racial differences in cornbread. You know that you know, even though this is not a clear division, there's a tendency in African American households to make cornbread that's a little sweeter, got a little sugar in it, and in white households to be more salty and savory. And I know as soon as I say that, some people are going to say, "No, I'm make it this way or whatever." But that's more of a trend, and I'm wondering if you see anything similar in biscuit making. Are there certain ways, certain types of people make biscuits that are different than others? Do you see any of those sort of differences in any way?
I don't see it like you see about the whole sugar and cornbread argument. I see a lot of people in the South tend to say you can only make biscuits with white lily flour. White lily flour is amazing. But it wasn't necessarily a prerequisite for me growing up. You know, it was never referenced to, like, oh, by the way, you cannot make biscuits without white lily flour. So I think that's the only thing. And I don't think that's a racial thing. I think that just might be a household thing. I'm not sure.
Right.
I don't think I haven't asked enough people. But yeah, that's really the only thing that I see. It's not quite like the cornbread thing at all.
Well, you've become known in Atlanta for sure for doing these pop-ups.
Mm-hmm.
And explain kind of how that came about and what your thoughts are on how you do that.
So it started initially as Sunday supper. So I just sort of took what I was doing in my house and, you know, just was blessed to know people who have restaurants and kitchen spaces that would allow me to cop a squat. and so I was doing those for a while, and through that I met a fantastic gentleman named Brian Furman.
Sure.
And so we sort of swapped stories about being from North Carolina. He came to one of my pop-ups, we were just sort of talking. It was actually, we met through Andrew Thomas Lee and the Kimball House guys here in Atlanta. And, you know, I had some apple butter, and he was eating a biscuit and he had some apple butter. He was like, oh, if you make me this apple butter, you can come and make it in my restaurant every day. And I was like, well, I'll bring you some over. So I don't know, it was a couple of days past something where I made another batch. And I took it over to him, and he was like, you ever thought about, you know, just sort of serving those biscuits on sandwiches in the mornings? And I said, yeah, I really hadn't worked out how I was going to do that. He was like, you want to give it a try here? And I said, sure. So, you know, it was a few months of planning, and we did a pop-up, that first one, and we had some coffee guys come by, and that one, I want to say I made over 500 biscuits. We sold every single one of them in 3 hours. And I had beignets and biscuit sandwiches. So
right.
Fried chicken, country ham, pimento cheese. Yeah, and that just sort of was like, okay, maybe we should do this again. So we had, you know, we just kept doing it. And Brian allowing me to use his space. And, you know, when he was available, he would be there too. And, you know, unfortunately, he had a fire at Bees Crackling, but it was kind of right on the cusp of, you know, when I was sort of making the decision of what my next steps would be. The pop-ups led to catering, so I do catering now, too, corporate catering. It kind of elevated me to the next step of, okay, so what is the next step for you, Erica, which I'm still working through.
Well,
reluctantly.
I was actually going to ask about that, because obviously there are lots of directions it seems like somebody like you could go. You could write a cookbook, or mm-hmm. you could open a restaurant, even though you saw how hard your grandmother worked and other family members worked doing that.
Yeah.
What kind of things are you thinking about?
Both of what you said are sort of things I've thought about. But for me, it would be creating a place where it would also benefit others. So I'll use an example. There's a bakery in London, and they sort of hire women who have been victims of domestic violence to show them, teach them skills and, work in their bakery. And I think sort of that. I had an opportunity to visit that bakery once, and I was reading the story, not even knowing what I had walked into. And so, you know, it wasn't too long ago, as I was thinking about what concept would ever be for me, it would have to be something that, you know, I could open the door for someone else to provide them with an opportunity, but also somehow be a business.
Yeah.
So it's just been sort of thinking through how I could do something like that. Totally the cookbook, slowly but surely, I had started on one, which was sort of a combination of the stories that my maternal grandmother told me and the recipes that went along with it. the journey of biscuits, mainly, from doing it pop-ups to people who do, you know, just sort of having this sort of book about biscuits, but not a book that has been written before about biscuits because they're out there. So, yeah, it's just sort of finding the time, you know.
Well, I'll let you go with one last thing. I wonder whether your grandmothers were around long enough to see you sort of circle back and kind of get into the food business and make this your life.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if they saw that and what they thought about it.
Well, I mean, I would hope they would be proud of me. I think if we were being honest, I think my grandma Dip would be more proud of me going that direction than my granny or Geraldine would be, mainly because, you know, she was sort of this sort of advocate for higher education and you know, and inserting yourself in places where people don't want you to be, and staying there. And powering through it, prestige and things. And I think she didn't see how that could be something you can obtain through service work. And I think that sort of comes from her being more, foot to the pedal of driving that civil rights movement, you know, and getting us, you know, we deserve these opportunities. We deserve to be in these schools and be doctors and lawyers. You know what I mean? So I'm not saying that she wouldn't be proud of me, but I think she would sort of look back and think it's funny that I'm, you know, that I would even be looking at something that my other grandma did.
Yeah. But, you know, you've talked several times just in our conversation about the underrepresentation of African Americans and women
right. In
all these categories. Do you feel like you're sort of serving that truth by the work you're doing?
I do. And I think, yes, I do.
My mama made thousands upon thousands of biscuits in her life. When she was young, they were sustenance for her family of sharecroppers working the cotton fields of South Georgia. When she was older, they were a treat for my dad, who sometimes wanted nothing but biscuits and cane syrup for supper. But after my dad died, mama announced that she was out of the biscuit business. She had made plenty. It's hard work to make a biscuit just right, and even harder to make them every day. They're not things you can do halfway. You need to make them out of duty or out of love. Erica Council has learned to love the work of food, even as she shied away from it as a kid because she saw how hard it is. Her biscuits are delicious, and that would be true if you knew nothing else about her. But they, like most things, are even better if you know the story. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where we have show notes for each episode with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.